Chapter 5. A half hour after Annette Martini called the police, a red and white 1956 Ford police cruiser pulled up in front of her house. She was glad it was in the middle of the day and not many neighbors were outside, but she knew some were likely to notice the police car and come out to see what was happening. A colored policeman got out. He was tall. Annette stiffened. It was unusual to see colored people in the neighborhood. She wondered why the police hadn't sent a white cop. He noticed her standing on the porch and approached. Annette stepped back. He started to come up the concrete steps. "Do you need to come up?" she asked harshly. The officer decided to be deferential. He moved his foot off the step. "No, ma'am," he said. "I'm Officer Jackson. Can you please tell me what happened?" "My daughter's been abducted," Annette exclaimed. Officer Jackson didn't react. "Are you sure of that, ma'am? Maybe she just went for a walk." "She's never done that. She can't. She's retarded and needs someone with her always." "Oh, she's handicapped," Officer Jackson said. Annette nodded. "I see." "You have to look for her. It's already been an hour," Annette lied. "Who knows where she could have been taken?" "I'll need a description before we can start looking. What was she wearing?" Annette had to think for a moment before she could describe Tina's clothing. "A yellow top and blue shorts and pink sneakers. And I'll need a recent photo that clearly shows her face." Annette didn't know how to reply. Not only did she not have a recent photo of Tina, she couldn't recall anyone in the family ever having taken any photos of Tina. Then she remembered. Tina had taken a photo when she finished sixth grade. I think there's one from school," she said. Officer Jackson nodded. "Good. Please go and get it. And don't worry, it will be returned." Annette had no idea where the school photo was. Her older daughter Vicky's high school graduation picture hung on the wall in the dining room. There were some snapshots of her younger sons Tony and Ralph when they were at the beach 2 summers ago. But where could Tina's picture be, she thought. "Oh, maybe it's in her room." "Wait here," Annette said. Then she went inside. Chapter 6. Maggie drove carefully. She left Germantown and headed toward her mother's small row house on Taney Street in Roxborough. Driving was still new for her. She'd never had a passenger before and didn't want to make any mistakes. When she reached Taney Street, Maggie parked the Studebaker in front of the house. She turned off the engine and got out. Tina didn't move. Maggie went around the car to the passenger side. She leaned down and looked at Tina. "Would you like to come in?" she said. She opened Tina's door and waited. Tina got out slowly. As soon as she was all the way out, Maggie closed the car door. "Come with me," she said. Maggie started walking toward the house. Tina followed her. She noticed the house was different from the one she lived in. It had no front porch and was set back from the sidewalk. A long stretch of lawn with a cement path led up to the door. There were some bushes on the front wall under the big window. Tina didn't know and wouldn't have cared that Maggie had recently inherited the house along with the old Studebaker. She'd also inherited several $1,000 and a cat named Simone. Her mother had left everything she had in the world to Maggie. Now Maggie was planning to share everything she had with Tina. Chapter 7. Maggie's parents had been named Daniel and Dolores. They had met at the Atwater Kent radio factory on Wissahickon Avenue in Germantown in 1930. Dan had been a supervisor on the assembly line, and Dolores worked in the office. They married in 1931. Maggie was born in 1932. The family moved to the house on Taney Street in 1933 when Maggie was 1 year old. The house had belonged to Dan's uncle Walter, who had never married. Walter had always liked Dan and left everything he had to his favorite nephew in his will. Dolores quit her job to take care of the baby and didn't go back to work until Maggie started elementary school in 1938. Then Dolores worked at several different stores in the Germantown Business District. After Maggie started high school, Dolores started working full-time again. Maggie had always done well in school, and Dolores had been proud of her daughter. All the nuns praised her. Maggie hadn't been any trouble as a teenager either. Strangely, she never had many dates. But that was okay with Dolores. She thought most of the neighborhood boys were juvenile delinquents, or beatniks, or both, and was glad Maggie didn't go out with them. Maggie also never had many girlfriends. In Dolores' opinion, The girls weren't much better than the boys were. After she graduated from high school, Maggie found jobs in some of the same Germantown stores where her mother had worked. She was a diligent worker, was never late, and took on extra work whenever she was asked to. But Maggie wasn't happy. When she was alone in her room after the workday or work week ended, she reflected on her life and realized it wasn't going the way she would have liked it. In fact, she hated it. 2 years after she graduated, Maggie told her parents she was thinking of becoming a nun. Her mother was shocked, but shouldn't have been. Maggie always had a special bond with the nuns at school. Dolores hadn't argued with Maggie, but turned colder after Maggie followed through and applied to become a novitiate. Although he felt baffled, her father was more supportive. Early in 1952, Maggie joined the Sisters of St. Joseph of Philadelphia. Their mother house was in Chestnut Hill. The order traced its origins to 17th century France. They came to St. Louis in 1836. From there, four sisters came to Philadelphia in 1847. Their first ministry was with orphans. Maggie ended up being assigned to teach at St. Francis Parish School in Germantown. Dolores resented that God had taken her only child and stopped going to church. She also was skeptical of Maggie's motives. Why had she become a nun? Was it out of her fascination with nuns? A desire to teach children? A great love of God? Or, as Dolores feared, merely a desire to get away from her parents? Dolores was grateful for one thing, however. Some orders sent their nuns to other cities, other states, or even faraway countries. Maggie stayed close to home. Germantown was only a few miles away. Then Dan died suddenly in 1955. He had been working at the Veterans Administration office in the defunct Atwater Kent factory. Dan had earned a decent salary. He also had a good pension and a lot of life insurance. Dolores found herself well off, but completely alone and became even unhappier. She no longer needed to, but kept working just to keep busy. In the spring of 1960, Dolores felt a sudden jolt in her brain. She grabbed her head and then fell against the kitchen table. A moment later, she almost blacked out. Then she collapsed on a linoleum floor. She needed Maggie, but her daughter was nowhere around. As Dolores lay on the floor, helpless, she said a quiet goodbye. She died, just after hoping Maggie would say a prayer for her. Mrs. Johnson from next door found Dolores the next day. She immediately called the convent and then the police. When Maggie arrived and saw her mother's corpse, she said a prayer for her soul. Then Maggie prayed for her own soul. Chapter 8. Annette found Tina's sixth grade photo on her nightstand. It was already 2 years old, and Tina's face had matured a little. She was a teenager now, but hadn't been when the picture was taken. Annette wondered where the time had gone. She tried to recall what their lives had been like 2 years earlier. Probably a lot like they are right now, she thought. But maybe they're about to change. Annette was right. Chapter 9. Maggie hadn't done anything to her mother's house since she started living there again. She'd left everything almost as exactly as it was when her mother was alive. It wasn't out of any sense of nostalgia or respect. Maggie couldn't decide what, if anything, to change. Her life had reached a place she never thought it would go. When she first became a nun, she thought her whole future was set. She planned to serve God until she was old. Then she would die and, hopefully, go to heaven. After her mother was gone, she didn't know where she was going to go, either in this world or the next. She hadn't found herself. Not yet, anyway. But today, she had found Tina and brought her home with her. It seemed a natural thing to do. The problem was that Maggie had no idea what to do next. Tina looked around inside of Maggie's living room. This is nice, Tina thought. It's prettier than my house. I like the flowers on the wallpaper, and the sofa looks comfortable. Does this lady live here? Will she keep me here? I hope she will. You'll be safe here, Maggie told Tina. It's a quiet neighborhood. Nobody bothers anybody. People keep to themselves. It'll just be you and me. Okay, Tina replied meekly. I have food, and I'll get you some other clothes. I don't have a TV, though. I hope that's okay. Sure. Good. I think you'll like it here. It was the first time in Tina's life that anyone had ever suggested that she could like anything. Mostly, things had just been given to her. Food, clothes, orders. Clean your room. Don't pick your nose. Leave that alone. Stop crying. She looked at Maggie and tried to recall who she was. Maggie noticed the puzzled look on Tina's face. Wait here, Maggie said. Maggie's living room had wallpaper with large, colorful flowers on it. Tina liked flowers, although she couldn't name any, and no one had ever offered any to her. Tina sat on the sofa. It was old, but seemed elegant. The fabric was a dark burgundy and felt soft. The sofa in Tina's house had been made of coarse tan cloth and was stained and ripped in places. Tina liked Maggie's sofa. Maggie returned a few minutes later. She was carrying what looked like a black dress. Remember this? She asked, smiling. Then she put on what looked like a weird hat and held the dress in front of her. Tina recognized what she was looking at. It was a nun's habit, although she didn't know that's what it was called. Now do you recognize me? Maggie asked. Tina nodded. She smiled and knew she would be okay. Chapter 10. Annette went back downstairs with the photo and headed out the front door. She overheard Officer Jackson talking to someone. Her handicapped daughter wandered off, he was saying. Another cop had arrived in a second police car. She can't have gone far, the other officer said. He was white. We can start a search. Yeah, she's getting a picture, Officer Jackson replied. He heard the screen door slam and turned. Oh, here she is now. This is Mrs. Martini. Annette ignored the colored cop and looked at the new officer. She handed him the photo. This is all I could find, she said. The white officer nodded. That's good, he said. I'll go back to the station and make some copies, and then we'll start a search. I'm sure your girl is okay. We'll find her, I promise. Please hurry, officer, Annette pleaded. She's never been alone for very long. She hoped she sounded convincing. He nodded respectfully. Yes, ma'am, we'll do our best. Then he turned and walked back to his police car. A moment later, Annette was alone with the colored cop again. She didn't know what was going to happen next. Just then, another car pulled up. It wasn't a police car. It was painted blue, and letters were painted on the side that said, WCAU News. Oh, shit, the color cop said. Then he turned, hoping Annette hadn't heard him. But she had.